those hands look neat.
They are
prana
now.
Prana?
Yeah. From the certain prana.
Well, they were part of their. I got it at the outlet store.
Oh, the prana or prana?
Prana.
Prana.
Like where's my cat?
Indian,
oh, okay, so they're like
they're
kind of like meditation pants.
Yeah,
just for relaxing ones. Cool,
yes.
Nice, cool. I like comfortable pants.
Are definitely failing in the circle category.
We're practicing imperfection.
Okay.
We're leaving space. No perfection, no imperfection.
It's just no curves anywhere.
Chaos.
Yes.
All right, let's see. I guess we'll go around and say names. Domio.
Domio.
Bob.
Frankie.
Frankie.
Jim.
Devin.
Devin.
Garrison.
Garrison.
David.
Mary.
Pat.
Pat.
Ishay.
Mark.
Rick.
Diane.
All right, well, in terms of announcements, next Saturday morning is the book. You call it the book club. I've heard it the book club a few times now.
Book
that's
group.
Kind of catchy.
Book study, whatever.
Book group, reading group. I like book club. It sounds kind of special.
Trendy.
Yeah. But everybody's... Anybody's welcome. It's a 10.
Yes, 10 to 11.
And you don't have to have read ahead of time. It's to pass the book around, kind of like we do, we'll do today, and then have a discussion. So, and that's right here. And then that evening, 6:30 p.m. at Myoju's house is a holiday party and potluck and talent, no talent. Show a little bit, do a little bit of that. So yeah, please consider showing up in the weekly newsletter. We have the link to directions to her house. And then we'll have holiday break. So essentially just think of it as between and including the holidays, so between, you know, December 24th, Christmas Eve day, and the 1st, you know, we won't meet in there. So that's two Tuesdays and one Sunday. And then we'll start up again after the 1st.
And Thursday.
And so two Tuesdays, one Thursday, one Sunday.
And one Saturday. Yeah.
And during that time, there is a New Year's Eve get-together, either at Dharma Rain
I think
or,
it's at Dharma Rain this year.
Okay. So
a pan-Buddhist.
Yes.
Like various Buddhist and Zen groups.
Yep. So everyone is welcome.
And maybe we'll try to put out an announcement about that in the newsletter.
Sure.
If you can gather that information or something, send it.
Essential information, like which site it's at.
And send it to me, then I'll get it to Myoju, we'll get it in the newsletter. And that's a very sweet way to usher in the new year if you don't already have plans, non-alcoholic way, and you sit right up until, first they have a potluck, and then have sacred dancing, and you participate in whatever you want to, and then
sacred dancing, I don't know,
a little bit like the Sufis do, but not so frenetic.
Hippie dancing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hippie dancing music. I never.
Static dancing.
And then you meditate right up until midnight, and then the priests serve everybody little cups of sparkling cider.
I just wanted to mention that the last couple of weeks we've been, after our Sunday Dharma talk, some of us have been going over to Market of Choice for lunch, and so I'll be there, and I think a couple of other people might be there, so it is fairly informal. Last week we found a table up the stairs that was kind of long, and we kind of collected there. You don't have to tell anybody you want separate checks, because in Market of Choice you just go find what you want, go through the checkout, and take your stuff up, so you can pick whatever you want of all the choices, you pay your own way, and then we visited, I don't know, for somewhere between an hour and a half, and the conversation was Zen Buddhist, kind of, but it was also about Sangha members, so it, you know, it covered that kind of thing. So, if you want to, Mary and I are closing for Myoju, and Rick's getting the sign. And but people who want to go could just go and collect upstairs, and we'll be there as soon as we finish up. Or I'll be there. I can't speak from here.
Excellent. And one more thing. The Awakening to Whiteness series is going to begin second Saturday in January. We only have about maybe about 10 people signed up, including me and Shintai. Hoping to get some more.
What time is it?
3 to 5 p.m.
How many months?
Six.
6 months, once a month.
Once a month on the second Saturday. And, you know, it's understood that maybe you might have to miss one of those. But, you know, I mean, the idea is it's a cohort thing, that you're going through this curriculum together. We'll be breaking into small enough groups, so they're like 5 or 6 people. And so there's a, you know, reading and video and stuff like that, assignments ahead of time, becoming more aware of racism and the phenomenon of whiteness, which really has nothing to do with, it's nothing to do with a person's race per se or the color of their skin. It has to do with a societal phenomenon pretty much worldwide, where there's a sense of dominance or superiority based on the lightness, the relative lightness of your skin, and how that's been built into our societies and power structures, and how many of us who are categorized as white are fairly oblivious to that, and yet very benefits from it that we don't realize, and so this is a really an educational thing.
I think it's worth reiterating that you found out about that, right, at your
priest conference?
At your priest conference, mm-hmm. And that it's Zen Buddhist or related to Zen.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's more general. Most of the readings are more general than that, but this is a curriculum that was put together by Buddhists, and then this particular one that we're going to be using is actually an adaptation of the more nationally available one that's even more specific to this area. So it is really tuned into, and it's really tied to practice. Yeah, I want that out as well.
One of the things I'm really looking for.
Yeah, that this is really about, you know, taking this opportunity to question our ideas of ourselves and, you know, face truth. Even if it's uncomfortable. All right. And if you're interested in that or you have more questions, just ask me or email me. Okay.
So today we're continuing with Robert Wright's Why Buddhism is True. And if you have anybody in your life who you would like to know, just you know a little bit more about Buddhism, but they're not interested in the religious stuff, or they already have a religion, or they, I don't know, scientific-minded, secular. I don't know. I think he does a really great job of explaining the deep, real practice-oriented aspects of Buddhism in that way. I'm thinking of buying a copy for my dad. Anyway, we've read a couple chapters out of it already, and I've skipped over a couple because some of his chapters are describing Buddhism, and we don't really need that, you know, okay. But what I'm particularly interested in is the chapters where he's talking about, you know, where theories of natural selection or psychological research and stuff kind of agrees with Buddhism and gives you another perspective on why Buddhist teachings are true and practices are effective. So, I'm skipping the chapter on the Buddhist idea about no self, and we're going right into chapter 6, your CEO is MIA. And there's lots of skip to another section notes because it's a long chapter. And Devin and Garrison, you don't have to read if you don't want to. Go ahead if you want to. But generally hold the microphone up nice and close to your chin.
From Why Buddhism is True, number 6, your CEO is MIA. Apparently, the Buddha's famous discourse on the not-self didn't immediately convert everyone to his way of thinking. Sometime after delivering it, according to Buddhist scripture, he runs into a man named Agivisana, a braggart, who has assembled a large audience to watch him vanquish the Buddha in a debate about the self. Agivisana begins the proceedings by challenging the Buddha's claim that the self can't be found in any of the five aggregates. He declares, "Form is myself. Feeling is myself, perception is myself, mental formations are myself, consciousness is myself." This is a pretty blatant provocation, a direct assault on the Buddha's worldview. But the Buddha, being the Buddha, remains calm. He says, "Very well then, I will cross-question you on this matter. If you have read many of the Buddha's discourses, you know that his convictions, that is, Agivisana's convictions, will not survive the ensuing dialogue in good shape. The only question is, which rhetorical tool the Buddha will use to dispel his interlocutor's confusion? Turns out, the answer is the king metaphor. The Buddha asks, would a consecrated noble warrior king, such as King Pasandai of Kosala, or King Ajatasutta Vediputta of Magadha, wield the power in his own domain to execute those who deserve execution, to find those who deserve to be fined, and to banish those who deserve to be banished? Yes, Master Gotama, answers Agivisana. He would wield it, and he would deserve to wield it. The Buddha then says, what do you think? Agivisana, when you say form is myself, do you wield power over that form? May my form be thus? May my form not be thus? Agivisana says nothing. The Buddha repeats the question. Agivisana remains silent. Agivisana answers the Buddha's question. No, Master Gotama. He doesn't, he admits, have complete power over his body. The Buddha then runs through the other aggregates, feeling, perception, and so on. Agivisana sees that, no, he doesn't have the power over any of these things that a king has over his domain. So the Buddha has made his point. You, the you that experiences feelings and perceptions and entertains thoughts, isn't really in complete control of any of these things. If you think that somewhere inside your head there's a kind of supreme ruler, a chief executive, well, there's some question as to where exactly you would find it.
Years later, the science of psychology is talking the Buddha's language. Well, not exactly his language. Psychologists don't often assert that you're not the king of your personal domain, since these days there aren't many kings who wield power over their own domains. Psychologists use more modern terminology, as Robert Kurzban, a professor of psychology at Penn, puts it, you aren't the president, the central executive, the prime minister. That is a matter of nearly unanimous agreement among psychologists. The conscious self is not some all-powerful executive authority. In fact, according to modern psychology, the conscious self has even less power than a jivasana attributed to it after the Buddha clarified his thinking. A jivasana was just acknowledging that on reflection, the various aggregates aren't under complete control. After all, if they were, then, as the Buddha was known to ask, why would they cause so much suffering? Modern psychology is making a stronger point. It's basically saying, you know how, on reflection, you conclude, along with a jivasana, that you're not in total control? Well, you're actually even in even less control than you conclude on reflection.
Of course, it's hard to admit that you're not king. And that's just the beginning. That's just because king seems like a great thing to be. It's because we feel like we're king. We feel like our conscious self is in charge of our behavior, deciding what to do and when. But a number of experiments over the past few decades have cast doubts upon this intuition of two minds. Among the most dramatic are those famous split-brain experiments. These were done with people whose left and right brain hemispheres had been separated via surgery that severed the bundle of fibers connecting them. Typically, the purpose of the surgery was to control seizures in the case of severe epilepsy. It turns out this surgery has little effect on behavior. Under normal circumstances, people with split brains act normally. But back in the 1960s, the neuroscientists Roger Sperry and Michael Gazinga devised clever experiments that led split brain patients to behave strangely. The key was to confine information to a single hemisphere by presenting it to only one half of a patient's visual field. If, for example, a word was presented only to the left visual field, which is processed by the right hemisphere, it won't enter the left hemisphere at all, since the hemispheres have been surgically separated.
It's the left hemisphere that, in most people, controls language. Sure enough, patients whose right hemisphere is exposed to, say, the word nut, report no awareness of this input. Yet their left hand, which is controlled by the right hemisphere, will, if allowed to rummage through a box containing various objects, choose a nut.
That finding alone could make you start questioning traditional notions of the conscious self. Now, consider this one. When the left hemisphere is asked to explain behavior initiated by the right hemisphere, it tries to generate a plausible story. If you send the command, walk, to the right hemisphere of these patients, they will get up and walk. But if you ask them where they're going, the answer will come from the left hemisphere, which wasn't privy to the command. And this hemisphere will come up with what, from its point of view, is a reasonable answer. One man replied, plausibly enough, that he was going to get a soda. And the person who comes up with the improvised explanation, or at least the person's left hemisphere, the part of the person that's doing the talking, seems to believe the story.
The split brain experiments powerfully demonstrated the capacity of the conscious self to convince itself that it's calling the shots when it's not. However, this demonstration was done with people who don't have normal brains. How about the rest of us, whose two hemispheres aren't separated? Do our brains actually make use of this capacity for self-deception? There is good reason to believe the answer is yes. In one much-cited experiment, the psychologists Richard Nesbitt and Timothy Wilson asked shoppers to appraise four pairs of pantyhose and choose the best pair. It turned out people had a strong tendency to choose the pair on the far right. But when asked why they had chosen that pair, they didn't say, because it's on the far right. They tended to explain their choices in terms of the quality of the pantyhose, sometimes going into detail about the fabric, the feel, and so on. Unfortunately for these explanations, the four pairs of pantyhose were identical.
Questions about how in control the conscious mind really is have now been raised from a lot of experimental angles. In a famous series of experiments first done in the early 1980s by Benjamin Libet, researchers monitored the brains of subjects while they chose to initiate an action. The researchers concluded that the brain was initiating the action before the person became aware of deciding to initiate it. This body of research is still coalescing. Not all the findings will hold up in the long run as the experiments are repeated. And in some cases, including the Libet studies, there are unsettled questions of interpretation. Still, at a minimum, it seems fair to say that the role of our conscious selves in guiding behavior is not nearly as big as was long thought. And the reason this role is exaggerated is that the conscious mind feels powerful. In other words, the conscious mind is naturally deluded about its own nature.
Of course, people don't always have inflated conceptions of themselves.
I think we skipped.
Oh, yeah, I might have misread it.
Did you turn back a page?
Yeah.
And how old are you? Turn the page. I got to hear, and then we didn't keep going.
So if you're a Buddhist philosopher, you may feel vindicated, but you may also feel puzzled. Why would natural selection design a brain that leaves people deluded about themselves? One answer is that if we believe something about ourselves, that will help us convince other people to believe it. And certainly it's to our benefit, or more precisely, it would have been to the benefit of the genes of our hunter-gatherer ancestors, to convince the world that we're coherent, consistent actors who have things under control. Remember the guy whose right hemisphere was told to walk and whose left hemisphere, when asked where he was going, said he was going to get a soda. His answer wasn't really true, but it does inspire a kind of confidence in him. He seems like a guy who's in charge of himself, who doesn't go around doing things for no good reason. Compare him with a guy who offers a more truthful account. I don't really know why I got up or where I'm going. Sometimes I just do stuff for reasons that make no sense to me. If those two guys were your neighbors in a hunter-gatherer village, which one would you want to go hunting with? Which one would you want to become friends with? During human evolution, the answers to such questions mattered. If you were thought unworthy of collaboration and friendship, your genes were in trouble. In short, from natural selection's point of view, it's good for you to tell a coherent story about yourself, to depict yourself as a rational, self-aware actor. So whenever your actual motivations aren't accessible to the part of your brain that communicates with the world, it would make sense for that part of your brain to generate stories about your motivation. Of course, coherence of motivation, though a desirable quality in a friend or collaborator, isn't by itself decisive. If someone has clear and consistent goals but always fails to reach them or fails to contribute much to team endeavors or doesn't keep promises, he or she won't be overloaded with friends and collaborators. So you would expect us to tell and believe not just coherent stories about ourselves, but flattering stories about ourselves. And by and large, we do. In 1980, the psychologist Anthony Greenwald invented the form benefectance to describe the way people naturally present themselves to the world as beneficial and effective. Lots of experiments have since then have shown that people not only put out this kind of publicity about themselves, but actually believe it. And they could be right. There are beneficial and effective people in the world. But one thing that can't be the case is that most people are above average in those regards. Yet study after study has shown that most people do think that they're above average along various dimensions, ranging from athletic ability to social skills. And this sort of self-appraisal can firmly resist evidence. One study of 50 people found that on average they rated their driving skill toward the expert end of the spectrum, which would be less notable were it not for the fact that all 50 had been recently in car accidents, and two-thirds of them had been deemed responsible for the accidents by police. If there is anything we're more impressed by than our competence, it's our moral fiber. One finding among many that drive this point home is that the average person believes he or she does more good things and fewer bad things than the average person. Nearly half a millennium after Montaigne died, science has validated the logic behind his perhaps too modest remark, "I consider myself an average man except for the fact that I consider myself an average man." And we don't just consider ourselves above average compared to a vaguely envisioned population of human beings at large. When put on a very small team, we tend to convince ourselves that we're more valuable than the average team member. In one study, academics who had worked on jointly authored research papers were asked what fraction of their team's output their own work accounted for. On the average four-person team, the sum of the claimed credit was 140%. The key word in the previous sentence is credit. When team efforts fail, our perceived contribution to the outcome shrinks. People are often aware of these forms of self-delusion. At least they're aware of them in other people. In one American study, experimenters described 8 different kinds of biases that are common in people, such as they tend to take credit for successes but deny responsibility for failure. They see their successes as the result of personal qualities like drive or ability, but their failures as the result of external factors, like unreasonable work requirements or inadequate instruction. In the case of all 8 biases, the average person said the average American is more susceptible than they themselves were. As Kurzban has summarized this finding, we think we're better than average at not being biased in thinking that we're better than average.
Of course, people don't always have inflated conceptions of themselves.
there is such a thing as low self-esteem, and there are explanations, speculative but plausible explanations, as to why it would make Darwinian sense for certain experiences to instill it. There are other differences as well among people that can influence the kinds of stories they tell and believe about themselves. In one study, people who ranked high on an extroversion scale and people who ranked high on a neuroticism scale both kept diaries about their everyday emotional experiences. Later, the extroverts recalled more positive experiences than they had in fact had, and the neurotics recalled more negative experiences they had in fact had. This is proof that self-inflation, though the norm in our species, isn't iron law. But note that both kinds of people were wrong. Their particular personalities had steered them toward different kinds of illusions, but in both cases, illusion is the operative word.
So, all told, we're under at least two kinds of illusions. One is about the nature of the conscious self, which we see as more in control of things than it actually is. The other illusion is about exactly what kind of people we are, namely, capable and upstanding. You might call these two misconceptions the illusion about ourselves and the illusion about ourselves and the illusion about ourselves. They work in synergy. The first illusion helps us convince the world that we are coherent, consistent actors. We don't do things for no reason. And the reasons we do them make sense to our behaviors, that our behaviors merit credit or blame. There is an inner us that deserves that credit or blame. The second illusion helps convince the world that what we deserve is credit, not blame. We're more ethical than the average person, and we're more productive than the average teammate. We have benefactance. In other words, if you were to build into the brain a component in charge of public relations, it would look something like the conscious self. The anthropologist Jerome Barkow has written, "It is possible to argue that the primary evolutionary function of the self is to be the organ of impression management, rather than, as our folk psychology would have it, a decision maker. The only thing I'd add is that the folk psychology itself may be part of the evolutionary function. Our presentation of ourselves as effective, upstanding people involves believing in the power of ourselves."
How so?
If you were designing a legal system that was going to have juries and people arguing together, and your issue was justice and fairness, you would have essentially an incompetent group to do the work.
Hadn't thought about that one.
Yeah. Which we knew, but now we have no idea.
Which is probably a large account for racism in that system. The actors think they think they're making a legitimate decision, but they're influenced by stuff they don't even realize.
I'm anxious to get further in the book. The other factors, the brain and personality, could play a role that he hasn't addressed yet. That's what I was thinking of.
So what's the? How does this make you feel?
Justified.
Below average.
Yeah, I'm kind of like, I don't really think I'm below average, but from now on I'm going to say I am.
Well, that's not nearly as true for me as it is for most of you.
It's embarrassing.
I think the issue is that I think I can decide when it's going to be advantageous to me to say I'm less advanced, you know, less capable, and when it's going to be advantageous for me to say I'm more capable, which is even more. I think I can figure it out. That's the conscious mind.
So
this morning. I woke up and I was laying in bed with my wife. And then I wasn't in bed. I was sitting up and putting my clothes on. And I'm absolutely unaware of making a conscious decision to get out of bed. And I think back, and that's been going on for a long period of time. I'm always amazed when I get out of bed because I never remember deciding to get out of bed. And it gets thousands more stories. Hmm. One of which is, every single time I went to jail, the thing that I went to jail with for made complete sense when I did it. And I get in jail and I go, what the hell was I thinking? So it was a perfectly logical thing to do when I did it, and a completely insane thing when I had consequences.
That's, I think that makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was a little foggy and confused. Sort of just kind of saying that, like, we think higher over ourselves naturally, a lot of people do.
That's part of it, but also just, you know, we have this strong sense of our conscious self. I call it my executive eye, like the one who's in charge, the one who's going to decide what I do today and how, what kind of person I'm going to be. And, you know, like, I'm the one that's deciding.
Right.
Even though a lot of times that person really doesn't manage to make things happen the way that she hopes, but we just like revise our story then, right? That whole thing is kind of put in place by natural selection. And interestingly, I find it so fascinating that it wasn't put in place by natural selection because we need it to function. He's suggesting, and I really think this is a great argument, it's put in place so we can communicate our experience, so that we can relate with other people and present ourselves as a person who an actor who has, you know, has coherence and has merit.
Right.
Social lubricant.
Yeah.
So, notwithstanding what we have just read, it gives me some comfort, not about myself, but simply gives me some comfort that within any given group of people, there in fact will be some who are better athletes than others, who are, let's say, more capable leaders than others, who can solve math problems better than others. I mean, this in fact does happen in the world. Now, as to the question of why it is that we seem to have this proclivity to overestimate our virtues and underestimate negative aspects, that certainly is puzzling.
Well, that's to sell ourselves and make our way. I mean, in a way, it's kind of morally neutral. I mean, you know, we want to, it's kind of like going for a job interview, right? And you've got to say, yes, I am, no, yeah, better than those other candidates, I can do this. You can bet I am a team player, I am a clear communicator. So we project ourselves that way, and it works to some extent.
It may even have to do with that we can act, that the side that decided that he was going for a soda is the side that decides to go for the soda. I mean, that can make the case that it's going to be okay, that I can do it, that I've got the skill.
Well, he said at the end, like, we believe it. Like, there's probably some adaptive value to actually believing that as well.
The issues of cultural effect are kind of interesting. First of all, some cultures are more group oriented.
Are you reading this book?
No.
Because one of the places I had a skip was, he said, one example of that is that, you know, we tend to, in Western cultures, we tend to rate ourselves high in the, like, you know, leadership and communication and all that kind of stuff. But then in Asian cultures, they'll rate them, rate themselves on more collective values, teamwork and respect and listening or whatever, those mm-hmm. kinds of things.
So it's, I mean, it's fascinating to get to that part because of the nature and nurture. Maybe I'll have to do this other time.
Yeah.
We had to, you know, a few million years ago, when we went out onto the savannah, we had to learn how to cooperate. And one of the reasons that we became the dominant animal is that the ability to communicate, the ability to cooperate, I think these characteristics might have been vital at the time for teamwork, communication, for, hey, yeah, we have to work together to take down the wild animal for dinner.
Yeah, and if you imagine, you know, interacting with somebody and seriously considering them as a mate or considering them as a business partner or as a friend or something, and if they kind of present themselves with this sense of confidence and positivity and not like total overblown, but, you know, we're going to get carried along by that and attracted to that much more than somebody who is just like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm probably below average on half of the measures.
Yeah, that's not a good catch. Catch for
yeah, it would be like, nah.
Pitching your case there.
Does he come to any conclusions except the theme of the overall book that Buddhism is true?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I think. I haven't read the whole thing yet, but I think is redeeming about it. It's not just, you know, criticizing us as human beings. He's going to make the gradual argument for how Buddhist practice can, you know, like, so natural selection has, you know, we've ended up with this package and this tendency toward self-delusion. And then what can we do about it? So actually at the end of the chapter, he just has kind of like a foreshadowing. He said he thinks that through practice, so in the second part of the chapter, which we'll read next time we go into this book, he says, rather than the executive self, the conscious self, being like the king, or maybe like the president, it's more like the speaker of the house. There's all these different modules in the brain, and they're kind of, you know, the conscious self is kind of, you know, whatever one rises to the top, it deals with, and it can influence a little, but he's saying, over time, we could make this speaker of the house really more into something like the president by really seeing what's going on and learning to be more skillful about it instead of just adopting this delusion about how it all works to actually become more skillful with it.
If my mind is telling me that I'm better, I think I'm better than I am, I can imagine it would also be the same that I think the rewards are better than they actually are, which leaves me with a kind of a subconscious sense of dukkha because nothing lives up to my expectation. Mm-hmm. So that dissatisfactoriness.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm thinking about is about 3 years ago, I had my thumb amputated because I had melanoma, and very successful, and clearly I'm a survivor, but that someone gave me this book called The Panda's Thumb, which I think may not be relevant completely now, but it was this collection of essays that Stephen Gould wrote, and he's both of his parents were linguists, so his grasp of language is phenomenal. It's pleasant to read just because he takes you along a theory of evolution, and all of a sudden you're saying, well, yeah, that's the one I always thought, and you've never thought that before, but you builds it to you so carefully. Well, one of the things about that book that also comes to mind is what we think of as natural selection. And I'm thinking of something I posted on Facebook about the in the climate talks, they came up with an understanding that some corals are adapting to the warmer water and surviving, and so that seems very hopeful. But it's also a form of selection that is adaptive. In other words, the same organism, coral, can do poorly or can do well. And it has to do with the characteristics that are adaptable that make them. And so it isn't like you lost the ability of something. It's like that's suppressed in natural selection because what you need more. And one of the other examples he had was reptiles. I think the reptiles are not very good on that part. That are swim when there's water and develop legs and walk when there's no water. And it isn't a different organism. It's the environment that changes the characteristics. And so the line that we're reading is on the two hemispheres of the brain right now. But there is an adaptation thing. So maybe he'll get there later about how we adapt this to our current circumstance, although we have to do it pretty fast because of technology.
Yeah, I think his emphasis is on Buddhist practice and what we can do with this strange karmic package that we've ended up with. But, you know, in case, I don't know, I could see a couple different reactions to this kind of information, and that's, you know, one is just, that's just a little too weird and uncomfortable. It's gonna think of something else. But it can also be, if you do contemplate it, it can be quite disorienting and kind of troubling in a way. I mean, who are we? Who are we really? How does stuff happen? Do we have any control over our lives? And
If we, you know, it raises questions about what's true. Huh? Because if you feel confident about yourself, that is a truth as far as you feel. But, you know, relatively or comparatively, it's a different story.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess I'll just throw out there and leave you with the, you know, the Buddhist answer to this, which he's going to get to in his own way, but it's essentially the most troubling thing about this for most of us is our attachment to the idea that the conscious self is us. We're like, that's, you know, we're that's me. And to think it's not me, then it just like, well, how the hell am I even going to function? Well, you've been functioning just fine without the conscious self really actually being in charge the way you think anyway. So, I mean, I remember earlier on in practice having this sense that I was, you know, I really wanted to settle into meditation and mindfulness and let go of the fog of preconceived ideas that we usually, you know, experience everything through. But I had this sense that if I really let go of it all, I really even let go of my sense of self, that I would just collapse into a blob, that I would cease to be able to function, that I, you know, it's kind of like holding on to, you know, I'm in the water and I'm holding on to something. Like, no, I can't let go of that. And yet to even, you know, I feel like it's kind of like we dip our toe in the water, you know, and then maybe we build up to the point where we can wade into the water. It's, you know, we try that, and there's a little moment where we let go of that, you know, really strong clinging to self, and we see everything still happens. We still walk to get a soda. We still get out of bed. We still respond to people frequently. We're responding, you know, in the course of conversation. I don't know if you've ever had the experience where somebody asks you something and you give a really appropriate response, a really compassionate response, or wise or thoughtful or something. Where did it come from? I mean, you didn't sit there and go, oh, this would be a great thing to say. It just comes, and you know that is, if they were able to map your mind, that response is arising before your conscious self, because I know it's only afterwards I go, well, that was pretty good, you know. And so it, in a way, it's the Buddhist message is it's okay. It takes some adjustment to get used to letting go of our fixed ideas of how we operate, but it'll be okay. And actually we can learn to be more skillful with the way that we actually are. Even, you know, we're going to still have these delusions. We're going to still be like, yeah, I am the most valuable team member on this team. Well, there goes that thought, you know. I mean, we don't have to believe it.
It makes me think of Okamura's comments on the five skandhas. And I have this sort of idea that it, instead of looking at ourselves as the one, the controller, we look at our different aggregates and say, okay, this advocate is in charge of this. I mean, sort of give them all a piece and realize that there's no just one, that they're all working together, that there's not one master controller, there's no one master computer controlling them all.
And that's what he actually goes. He actually goes into, you know, the kind of the current thinking about, well, how do our decisions get made? Mm-hmm. And that essentially there's all these different modules in the brain, which they're not separate. They overlap and cooperate, so networks or whatever, for different functions, for even like detecting lying in other people or whatever. And they're all operating. And they all, this is also explains our experience of conflict. Mm-hmm. We want to, you know, eat the donut. We don't want to eat the donut. Both are true. There it is. We've got the modules going. So we really can be more, learn to be more a wiser ruler, maybe. You know, that it's not we can't just, you know, impose our will on all of this. That's not how it actually works. But we can, I don't know, learn to pay more attention, learn how it all works. Oh, okay. So then we really can. We know we do have freedom of choice. We can say, all right, I feel a powerful urge to eat that donut. There's part of me that's saying I'd be a terrible person if I ate that donut. All right. What do we really want to do here? You know? Make a wiser choice. Well, thank you all for coming.
Provocative. Yeah.